Good.
That was weird.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Education, Workforce Development. It's Friday, February 17th. We're going to start with our three work sessions today. Unfortunately, House Bill 2410 is not ready. We're still working on Representative Wisnett's amendment, so we're going to wait on that one. Rather than, he was kind enough to be open to the possibility of sending the bill forward and continuing to work on the amendment, but rather than putting us through two House votes, an initial vote and then a concurrence on an amendment, I think we should just wait and get that amendment done here, and then do it in one swap. So we will wait on 2410. With that, we'll start with a work session on House Bill 2408. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2408 changes the name of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development within the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, changes title of Commissioner of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to Director of Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, changes name of Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development account to Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development account, transfers rulemaking authority and designation as recipient of appropriations from Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We have dash two proposed amendments that make additional statutory substitutions of Higher Education Coordinating Commission and its Executive Director for the State Board of Higher Education and its Chancellor and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development and its Commissioner, also adds an emergency clause and makes the bill effective July 1, 2015. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the measure, so have decided to request a rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And have we received
We have received authorization to do that.
Very good. Okay. So with the dash two amendments, we'll have completed the technical additions and be ready to go. Representative Gallegos?
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2408.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 2408. Any discussion of that motion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. The dash two amendments are adopted to House Bill 2408. Representative Gallegos?
Chair Reed, I move the I move House Bill 2408 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved House Bill 2408 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2408 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. For the first time in this committee, we need a carrier. Would anyone like to carry House Bill 2408? Representative Nierman will volunteer. Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2408 and open a work session on House Bill 2409. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2409 abolishes unfunded higher education loan, scholarship, and grant programs, combines fund accounts for alternative student loan programs, scholarships for foster youth nursing service program, and nursing faculty loan repayment program to allow for consolidated accounting, separates statute regarding scholarships for foster youth and scholarships for dependent children of deceased and disabled public safety officers into two statutes, declares an emergency as effective on passage. We have dash one proposed amendments which remove the language or address the issue that the Oregon Citizens Association brought to us during our public hearing. We have a revenue statement that requires further analysis, which is fine because this bill is going to Ways and Means and a minimal fiscal.
Very good. Representative Gallegos?
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2409.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2409. Any discussion of that motion? These are, of course, based on the testimony from the Nurses Association, wants to retain one of the programs that had previously been proposed to be consolidated. Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. Dash 1 amendments are in. Representative Gagos?
Sure. Chair Reed, I move House Bill 2409 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior preference.
Thank you. Representative Gagos has moved House Bill 2409 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2409 is on its way to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session. Representative McKeown.
I'm just going to say, Chair, I'd be happy to carry this bill if you'd like.
It goes to Ways and Means.
I appreciate the offer, and I'll take you up on that on another
later.
Bill. It goes
Thank
to Ways
you.
And Means.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem.
I wasn't.
Nope,
paying attention.
No problem at all. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2409, and that completes our work sessions for today, and we'll move on to our public hearing, first public hearing on House Bill 2407. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2407 provides that all qualified students receive second year of Oregon Opportunity Grant funding if they meet academic standards and benchmarks established by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission by rule. Directs the commission to adopt rules regarding Oregon Opportunity Grant program that include maximum grant amount, authorizes commission to prescribe grant application deadlines, and to prioritize awarding of grants to qualified students with highest financial need. Declares an emergency, is effective on passage.
Thank you. We have just three people signed up. Perhaps there will be some more. Ben Cannon, Larry Roper, and Bob Rue, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of our Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Thanks for hearing this bill, which is has emerged as a significant priority for the commission this session. We appreciate the public hearing today. Want to note that there are amendments under development. They are significant amendments. They will significantly substantially replace the bill that you have in front of you. So we'll speak to the sort of general contours of those amendments today, but have talked to the chair about providing some additional time for particularly public testimony on this when we get those amendments back and folks have the opportunity to look at them. I'll provide just a little bit of background and then turn it over to the experts, Larry and Bob, to brief you on the concept that's moved forward. As you know, the Oregon Opportunity Grant is the state's need-based financial aid program for students, and students who attend Oregon public and private universities are eligible based on need. The idea of the grant is that it should meet the unmet need, the difference between the full cost of attendance for a student and the student's ability to contribute to that cost of attendance through work, through other forms of financial aid, through borrowing if they're attending a public university or private university. And as you know, the state has fallen significantly short of funding that unmet need. And this slide, a version of which you saw in our first presentation to you, has a lot of information, but I'll sort of direct your attention to the blue line and the red line. The blue line is the number of applications, eligible applications that we receive for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The red line are the number of recipients. The gap essentially reflects unmet need. The green bars, just for reference, are the dollars that the state has put into the program biennium over biennium. You see the significant increase in 2007 when the shared responsibility model that I've sort of roughly described was adopted. So there was a significant increase, but it's basically been flat since then. Meanwhile, need has increased quite substantially, and we have the vast majority of students not served, even though they are eligible, and those who we do serve, we don't serve completely. In the face of the gap, the Oregon Student Access Commission, now the HEC, has had to figure out, well, what do? You have a lot more applicants than you have dollars. You have a lot of unmet need, and we've essentially triaged that gap and triage those students by capping the award amount at about $2,000 for full-time students and by creating a deadline for the award. And so students who apply later than roughly February 1st do not receive any award at all, and that's reflected in the blue and red. As a result of that, in 2013, several legislators, including members of this committee at that time, came to folks in the chancellor's office, in the governor's office, elsewhere, and said, perhaps there's a better way of using whatever dollars we've got in the Oregon Opportunity Grant to award grants to students. Perhaps capping award size, going with first come, first serve, isn't the best way to promote the state's goals of completion, persistence, and completion and equity. And we agreed at that time to work with the Oregon Education Investment Board and with the HEC to create recommendations for a different method, potentially a different method of awarding the dollars. And so what Larry and Bob will describe today are the results of that work that's really gone on now for well over a year. I know it's customary and appropriate to allow others to introduce themselves, and I will do that. I do want to just note Larry Roper, associate provost, a longtime associate provost at Oregon State University, a real leader on that campus around student affairs issues in particular, and Bob Brew, our executive director, who's really pulled the Office of Student Access and Completion into a new era of success and took on a challenging assignment a couple of years ago and has done wonders with that work. So I'll turn it over to Larry.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chair Reed, committee members. My name is Larry Roper, and I, as Ben said, I served many years at Oregon State University in the role of Vice Provost for Student Affairs and happily transitioned to faculty member in January. So I'm now a faculty member in the School of Language, Culture, and Society. And I want to just spend a few minutes talking a little bit about just the committee's approach to the charge and the outcomes that we generated as a result. And so as you can see from the slide, the charge for us was to recommend a restructured opportunity grant that would achieve the goal of improving access to higher education, but also that would really be focused on, you know, the most financially needy, most promising students, and that would really stimulate a 40-40-20. And I'll talk about that just a few minutes from now. The working group was comprised of just a broad cross-section of people from the higher education communities and stakeholders, and we also had resource specialists, people who were really knowledgeable about the application of any kind of grant process and the awarding of aid, because in the end we knew that we needed a process that was going to be workable, not only responsibly use the funds, but that also could be implemented in a way that would get to students in a responsible way. So just the group began working in November. We worked through to April, provided some recommendations to a group that we suggested should really attend to the technical aspects of the outcomes that we had generated. And so the main recommendations we came up with in our work was to restructure the grant to serve the most financially needy students. That, you know, as you could see from the presentation, the slides that Ben presented, there was a huge gap, and there was a wide range of people who were eligible for the aid. You know, and the question was, how do we target it? And so we thought that, first of all, thinking about the needs of the most needy students was a place to begin to sort of draw that line. And within that we would sort of try to prioritize within that funding for underrepresented racial and ethnic minority students. Again, that was a part of our charge around how to increase access to higher education from those underrepresented communities. But also, one of the things that became very clear to us in our conversations was that 40-40-20 was not an access initiative; it was a success initiative. it was the state's goals for what we wanted to achieve, and that required that we actually get people through the pipeline in order to get there. And so we thought that it was really important to begin to adopt some kind of requirements that would show that people who were receiving the aid and were receiving the aid beyond the first year would make some progress. So we wanted to begin to build achievement into the awarding of the grant. And so as a result, we also felt that we would add to that some predictability that will allow students to plan and to know that the grant was durable, that they could count on it for more than 1 year, and that we needed to get out of the sort of first come, first serve, and we needed to bring a little bit more logic to it. And so we began to think about sort of a rolling process. it was very clear that we needed to sort of make a commitment to pursue additional funding to more fully meet the need, that we could sort of tinker around the edges, but ultimately it was going to be a financial issue, that we just didn't have enough money to fully commit to the shared responsibility model. And because we felt like we had, at the end, we sort of reached the design that we thought would be workable, that we would then ask that an implementation group pick up the mantle from that point forward and begin to work on that. But we also felt that we would be remiss if we didn't address the what we thought was a broader issue, which was how do we create a college-going culture, or at least an educational high-aspiration culture within the state, by beginning to try to figure out how do we nurture people's goals and dreams at an earlier age. And so this idea that at some point we need to consider whether there's some kind of pipeline affordability model that we can pursue by beginning to sort of incent students, even at the elementary school level, to begin to think about higher education. And we think that that's an important agenda for us to pursue later. And so with that, I think Bob will talk about sort of the design team and the work they did after that.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Bob Brew. I'm the executive director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, and it's a pleasure to be here today. Commissioner Roper mentioned the working group that he chaired, and then the design team or the implementation team that came after that. And if I was going to use an analogy, it would be that I viewed that working group as sort of an architect, and the design team kind of as the general contractor. That they take their ideas and make them work in the trenches. And so the design team was made up primarily of folks that work in financial aid offices across the state, because we knew that whatever design we came up with had to be implementable, if that's a word, in the universities and colleges where the work would actually take place. So we met, I believe, about five times over 7 or 8 months to kind of talk about how could we make this work. Did several models, huge data sets of models, to say if we tweaked this, what would happen? If we did that, what would happen? And we came up with, using the guidelines presented by the working group, came up with a model that said, look, we need to serve the neediest students first. And we use the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA, as our application for our grant. The FAFSA gives, you put a lot of data in. It's a little bit of a black box. But at the end, you get what is called the expected family contribution, or EFC. This is supposed to be, and it actually is, a pretty good reflection of a family's ability to contribute to the education of their child. It takes into account not only income, but family size, number of students or number of children, number of students in college, the assets of the family. It takes, I believe, there's 110 questions in the form, and so it comes out. It does its machinations, and it comes out with an expected family contribution. And we said, you know, in terms of greatest need, let's look first at students with an expected family contribution, basically of zero. They have nothing to bring to the table. That doesn't mean in the shared contribution, or in the shared responsibility model, that they don't contribute to their education. There's expectations for work. There's expectations for loans if you're at a university. But the family doesn't have the resources to kick up cash in addition to those other resources. So we said, let's look first at students with expected family contribution of zero. This may be amazing to hear, but nearly 60% of college students have an expected family contribution of zero. And so we said, well, let's look first at helping those students. And then once we were able to do that, let's look next at students with an expected family contribution of $1 and $2 and so on up. So really tried to concentrate really on the neediest of the needy as we go forward, and then build into the legislation a mechanism that says, okay, as we can reach them, the income range or the expected family contribution range that we'll serve will increase. The second thing that we did was we looked at the, because we're serving a a broad, if this makes sense, a broad but narrow slice of students. The shared responsibility model includes students with a family income up to $70,000. So that includes a lot of students. The expected family contribution of zero is a smaller pool, and because of that, we can look at extending the application deadline. Working group asked that we do a rolling application deadline, and we actually got some feedback from the universities and colleges that said, we can't do that. We have to have time before the start of the term to actually put financial aid packages together. So please don't make it kind of open-ended. Have a cutoff at some point before the start of the term. And so we, rather than doing a purely rolling deadline, we're looking at doing a series of deadlines potentially before the start of each term. This is for the benefit of the school, and also we know that students that apply the day before school starts generally are least likely to complete the term. So, and that's the feedback we get from the schools. Another important consideration, we're guaranteeing students a second year of opportunity grant if they continue to meet the income requirements and meet the satisfactory academic progress requirements that are set by the federal government or by the school that they're attending, if those requirements are higher. So that becomes, I guess, the first part of the what will be an amendment. We're also working with another idea that will become that we're doing more analysis on, and we're calling it the tuition promise. The idea is currently, according to the federal government and most colleges and universities, if you take 12 credits a term, you're a full-time student. If you take 12 credits a term for 4 years, you will be a full year short of getting your bachelor's degree. So the opportunity grant is only available for 4 years of full-time study. So our goal is to create an incentive, a financial incentive, for students to go ahead, take on the extra work, and do 15 credits a term. If you do 15 credits a term for each term of 4 years, you'll graduate in 4 years. Currently, there's no incentive, and there is some extra cost to doing that. And so we're trying to create an amendment that would recognize that and provide an incentive for students to do that. But we're just still doing modeling on that. That's still very early. And that's about all I had. So I think we're all available for questions.
Great. I think there will be some. Representative Reardon, get us started, please.
When you develop your new improved plan, how much student input or how much of your target audience did you get input from them, or did students get a chance to review the plan so they could confirm that this would be helpful?
Yes. So thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon. We had a representative from the Oregon Student Association that was actually on Commissioner Roper's group. We have presented to the Oregon Student Association leadership, answered questions, and they've been very involved all along.
Representative Reardon, I should restate what Ben mentioned briefly at the beginning, which is that when the amendment is ready and they come back, we'll have some additional opportunity for public testimony. I would expect that the Student Association and students might be amongst those who want to testify at that point.
Okay. Yeah.
Other questions? Representative Williamson, then Representative Gagos, then Representative Nierman.
So in your review of not only access, did you look at the restructuring of the system and what that would do around completion, and how those two work together?
Did you want to? So, Representative Reed, Representative Williamson, yes, we did look at that very much, and it's a challenging model, because we know that that if you just look at broad statistics, and I'm an economist, that's where I come from. If you look at broad statistics, middle and income higher income students are more likely to graduate. And so as we focus need on the poorest of the poor students, the neediest of the needy students, there could be a potential impact that they won't graduate at the same rates. But we do know that the opportunity grant for the students that get it is much higher than for the students that don't. And so we're really wrestling with that. We want to, we expect schools through the through other legislation and potential agreements to provide more supports for students. Mm-hmm. So it's intended to be part of an integrated system of supports that include both access and completion.
Yeah, Chair Reed, Representative Williamson, we looked at that as a part of our initial work group, and we actually brought in a facilitator from who worked with the Lumina Foundation nationally to come in and provide us with national data around the kinds of structures of programs like this nationally. And one of the things that we know that it's not just the aid program, but it's also the institutional supports that are really important variable in that, and it's really sort of the institutions when we spend a lot of time talking about, quite frankly, the ethical responsibility that they have, that once we bring in the needier students, that you recognize that full suite of needs that they bring with them and that the institutions construct the supports. So finances are a part of it, but institutional structure is also a significant part of it.
Waiting to see if you had a follow-up.
I'm thinking.
We'll come back to you if you do, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Gallegos.
Actually, you addressed kind of part of my question. I was just curious about what's the average size of the grants, and is that a constant variable each year? Do they get the same amount? Or?
Representative Reed, Representative Gallegos. So the currently is $2,000 a year for a full-time student, which is defined as 12 credits a term, $1,000 for a half-time student, which is 6 credits a term or more. We'd like to at least raise that to $2,100 and $1,050 this next year.
Kind of follow.
Yes, please.
So what percentage of say a total annual cost would that be? In other words, it kind of gets at the other part of the question as to when you think about tuition, you think about books, you think about meal plans and housing. I guess that what I'm getting at is that I've heard from students who might get a grant like this, but it's still just not enough, and so they can't, you know.
Yes, thank you. The for a community college, it's maybe 10%, somewhat quite a bit less than that at sure, for instance, sure. University of Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman, then Representative McEwen, then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Mr. Brew, on the previous slide, on slide 9 there, at the bottom it says continue to meet other eligibility criteria. What are those criteria?
Oh, thank you, Representative Reed, Representative Nierman. The eligibility requirements are a financial need. So,
can I follow?
Please.
So, if I go back to slide 2, and I was going to say this question's for Mr. Cannon or Mr. Brew, but I'm biased towards the economists, so I'll toss it to Mr. Brew first here. But you have such a large gap here, and so you're not going to be able to give the grant to every student that needs it. And I'm happy with managing the incentive to say we're going to give it to the neediest people first, and that's going in the right direction. But after that, then the criteria kind of drops off. You have to maintain your academic standards, and that, of course, makes sense and all that. But, you know, I can't help but think I'm in this committee, and one of the other things that this committee does is we talk about innovation stuff where they give grants. And I look at the criteria there, and it's not random. And they even say, we have people that apply for grants, and you didn't get it right this time, but come back next time, and maybe you can convince us next time. And it seems like there's a whole nother level of accountability that is possible here because you don't have enough money to fund everything. I mean, you're an economist, and that was when I took economics, that was the first thing they talked about was scarcity, but which is fine. So is there any opportunity to put something else in there? And what I truly have in mind is something like What's your prospects when you get out of school there? So if we've identified you as a needy kid, and here you are, and you want to major in basket weaving or something like that, we say, well, you know, we already are giving the grant to three basket weaving people, and we've kind of decided that Oregon has enough basket weavers, whatever. Maybe you could consider accounting or law or engineering or STEM or something like that. Just comment on that. Thanks.
Representative Reed, Representative Nierman, thank you. That's an excellent question. The challenge is one of timing. So we're right now taking applications, and schools are preparing to award students for students that will start in September. So in a lot of cases, if these are freshmen, they've not only not declared a major, they've not necessarily even firmly decided on what school they're going to go to. So that's definitely a challenge. So we would be, even if, since most students declare a major in their third year, it would be well in advance of that. And that information is also not collected on the FAFSA, so it would kind of create an administrative burden. We did talk a bit about do we target specific majors, do we target specific fields of study, and the working group decided that was probably unworkable and speaking for myself, perhaps maybe could get in the way of any implementation at all because it's kind of controversial. So. Yeah.
Did you want to add to that?
Yes, Representative Reed, Representative Nierman. The committee spent a lot of time on that because we knew that was really an important issue, and it's certainly part of the large public discourse around higher education, whether or not we're preparing students for careers. But we also felt that one of the things by asking students to do that at such an early age and make those declarations is that they hadn't had exposure to the resources of the institution, and some of them go through a redeciding process as they go there, as they gain exposure to the possibilities and where their strengths are. And so we felt that to narrow the pipeline in that way by saying you don't have the right goals, and therefore this is going to be a screen to opportunity for you, we started to write, frankly, feel like we were sort of going down some on some ethical thin ice in that regard. So we just decided that really just setting success measures in terms of achievement was really a safer way to go. By wherever you go, you just need to be successful at that, and you need to ensure that the resources are going to produce positive outcomes for the state's investment.
Can I follow one more? So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's interesting, and thank you for that feedback. And I guess I get it that if you have students that are early in the process, they don't have a major, and then I've got the been there, done that, got the T-shirt on changing my major as in college and stuff. So I know about that. But it's interesting when you talk about the ethics of requiring a goal or requiring a goal that meets the needs of the economy or something like that. I almost think that you have an ethical imperative to do something like that for a couple of reasons. First of all, you're using taxpayer resources to make an investment, and so it needs to be a good investment. And the second of all, if you give someone a grant and get them into school or something like that, and like Representative Gallegos pointed out, that this grant's not going to cover everything. So you're going to walk out of that school with some debt there, and it would be nice, ethically, I would feel better, that handing someone that chunk of debt and their degree, but knowing that that degree was in something that was going to be able to work off that debt. And so almost think like ethically, if you come from the, if you're a trust fund baby, I don't care what you major in and you can do whatever you want, you know. But if you're coming from, kind of a needier family, needier situation or something like that, I think as a society, as a state, we have a duty to make sure that we, if we're going to give you that debt, that we give you the means to survive that debt. So yeah. You can comment on that if you like.
Yeah, I would. I you hitting close to home. I'm a father of an 18-year-old who wants to be a philosophy major.
Can I interrupt you? I have a degree in philosophy, so you're speaking my language.
But I'm paying. I think that there is a challenge, and I just want to just go back a little bit on my experience working with students for the last 40 years or so, and that there are students who come who consciously make the choice that they want to go into debt to do work that may be public service in nature. That they decide they want to go back and work with the community, and that they want to major in sociology or history or whatever, and that their goal is to go back and serve a community, and that they're willing to take the debt to do that. I mean, and so part of it is it's a really important question, mm-hmm. of what role do we put ourselves in telling people where we will offer support, or where we will, what are the things for which we will not provide support. As a chair of the group, I feel like that was a really huge step for our committee to put ourselves in the positions to be the ones to do that. I'm not saying it's not a good question, and it's not a worthy one that's worthy of our consideration and our effort, but I think in terms of our committee, we just didn't feel as if that was a place we wanted to put ourselves.
Thanks for your feedback on that. I appreciate that.
It's a good discussion. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. It is a wonderful discussion, and I think I appreciate the philosophical nature of where we've gone. But I think I might want to bring it back just kind of to the nuts and bolts of what financial aid looks like for people on the panel who may not have been through the process, mm-hmm. either personally or with kids. Could you just paint a picture for me, Mr. Brew, of what a financial aid package looks like for somebody with a zero EFC, all of the components of it?
Sure. So thank you, Representative Reed, Representative McEwen. So a financial aid package is generated by the college, and essentially it takes, if you can imagine, a kind of a spreadsheet with costs on one side and resources on the other. And it will start out with the total cost of attendance, which includes tuition, fees, books, living expenses, transportation, personal needs.
And Chair Reed, I just sent that to you. I don't know if you can send it out to the committee, the student budget document.
Yeah, I'm sure we can. Thanks.
And then on the other side, it will be the resources that could be applied to that. So this could include the federal Pell Grant for the neediest students. It could include, there are other grants that are available federally for various subcategories of students, the Oregon Opportunity Grant potentially, if the university has done any kinds of what we call remissions, which might include actual university scholarships or university tuition discounting and so on. And at some point the gap is filled up with loans.
And there may be an opportunity for work study.
Work study, yeah, thank you.
Student to participate for a few hours a week, yeah. So there's a whole range of things that the students can apply for or may receive. It's not a simple process. It's very complex, and there are a lot of components to it.
Absolutely.
That's really true. Representative Johnson, then we'll come back to Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, panel, for being here. This is a topic that this committee has discussed multiple times in my tenure here. So we all know that there's an inadequate resource. You know, we just don't have enough to meet everybody's need. But what we're proposing to do is concentrate a greater percentage of that need in fewer hands. So obviously there will be some pushback from some sectors there who would rather spread it as thinly as we can and try to touch as many potential beneficiaries as we can. But my greater concern, I think, is ensuring that if, in fact, we're going to re-up for the recipients for multiple years, I think for me to be supportive of this plan, there's going to have to be some skin in the game for the institution as well, i.e., that student is going to have some sort of relationship with a mentor, counselor, guidance advisor, whatever, to ensure that they're on an academic pathway that makes some sense. Is that something that you guys discussed, or will that be included in the amendments that we are going to be receiving coming shortly?
Representative Johnson. That was, we actually, when we were having our work group, we actually did one session where we focused on institutional supports. We've not yet designed that into this piece. It wasn't part of the design group's work. But one of the things that was very clear to us as a work group was that there had to be institutional structures to support the success and ensure that that pipeline was going to be as smooth as possible in terms of students receiving the kind of mentoring and supports that they need. Just knowing what's happening at the institutions, I know that many institutions are focusing on that now because outcomes, you know, accrediting agencies and others are really focusing on, are they achieving outcomes in terms of retention and supports with the neediest of students?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, I think it's important to look at this proposal in the context of the larger work that the HAC and the state is doing to shift funding incentives for institutions and for students. So this roughly 115 million, potentially next biennium, $135 or $140 million investment is represents, you know, maybe 10% of the total state investment in higher education. And that other 90%, as you know, and we've touched on previously, is also under significant discussion by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission with proposals for new ways to allocate in order to drive incentives at the institutional and the individual level for success. And our premise in that work, in new allocation formulas, in part, is that an emphasis on outcomes will drive institutions to place increasing resources into guidance, mentoring, counseling, and other mechanisms that support student success, and will reward institutions financially for doing so. I think we're also on the university side, and it gets back to Representative Meerman's really good question. We're proposing to use those new allocation models to target resources to higher cost and higher demand degrees on the university side. And again, so you can see ways in which this notion of using the state dollar more effectively, targeted to incentivize outcomes, is reflected in the opportunity grant proposal. There's a sort of larger context and other work underway with even larger amounts of state dollars that are also sort of follow that same logic of we can't do it all, so how do we focus resources on the outcomes that are of greatest importance to the state?
Just to follow up then, so again, to go back to my point, in the amendments that you're working on, is there going to be some mention in there of institutional responsibility as well to make sure that this student that's going to be the beneficiary of a multiple-year Oregon Opportunity Grant is in a place that's going to lead to some sort of completion, either an AA or a four-year degree?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, we are in process of working on those amendments, and would be happy to sit down with you and go over them and look for ways to include such a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rudin, and then Representative Gagos, I think.
I guess just kind of a question, maybe it's philosophical, I don't know. But it's obviously we don't have enough funding to do everything we want, and we're trying to figure out ways to get more money for the students directly, but I keep hearing the term institutional supports over and over, and I know we need to do some, but is anybody really looking at, are we doing the right balances of money going into institutional supports versus giving it directly to the student? And our, because just in my history with various institutions, things seem to become ingrained. They become a support. Maybe it started in the 50s or something, and it's just always been there. It's always been a good idea, and we just continue doing that. Does anybody ever do like a zero-based budget for these programs and look at them all together?
Representative Reed, Chair Reed, Larry or Bob may have thoughts on this as well. And there's a risk that we'll sort of veer into a ways and means conversation here, that I will. But part of the reason, I believe, for creating the Higher Education Coordinating Commission was to address directly that topic, at least from the standpoint of state investments, looking broadly at higher education, including opportunity grants, need-based aid, including institutional support, including tuition, which we don't set, but we have the right to approve or disapprove university increases of greater than 5% annually. We are meant to bring forward a proposal for state investment that reflects the optimal balance. We have tried to do that as a new commission and new staff in this biennium, and I hope our work on that improves, because you're right, these things rarely get taken into account together, get taken into account holistically. That's what we're attempting to do. I will, just final point on this, underscore the fact that state investment is such a small percentage of total funding for higher education, with tuition, of course, federal dollars being larger drivers, frankly, that I don't have quite the right analogy here, quite the right metaphor, but we're a small tail on this sort of much larger ship of higher education in Oregon, and that sort of limits, I think, in very significant respects, the extent to which we can fully and meaningfully have that conversation. Nevertheless, our responsibility for advising you on roughly $1 billion annually of state investment in higher education suggests we need to do that well.
Thank you. Representative Gagos, and then Representative McEwen.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I just a comment. I think that what I'm thinking about it as you present is really, as you're pointing out, all different balls that are being tossed in the air at the same time. And just I'm reminded of Ms. Burns' study with the universities, and her comment that advising seems to be the one thing that sort of pops out as the most critical element in terms of this institutional support structure. While I believe that, I just am concerned, too, that really would take a significant change in the culture of our institutions. I mean, it's like faculty tend to be the advisors, but they don't get tenure credit for that advising activity. So how do we begin to sort of change that whole structure is a major question.
Mr. Faculty Member?
Yeah.
Dr. Faculty Member, excuse me.
Well, Representative Gallegos, Representative Reed. I agree with you that advising, I mean, the research does show that advising is really a crucial piece of that. Again, if you were to look at higher education institutions right now, particularly those in Oregon, many of them are actually focusing on that first year experience. They're doing things to begin to think about this notion of front loading resources. I know that OSU 2 years ago, we just implemented a comprehensive first year experience program, which sort of has very clear requirements for the kind of advising and the kind of engagement that we're trying to stimulate with students, and with the expectations of regular meetings with advising. So advising has actually become much more intrusive as opposed to an optional activity, which we had moved away, which we had moved to in with the goal of giving students more freedoms. Well, what we found was that the freedom led to a lot of wandering. It didn't lead to sort of as clear of a path with students. And so those things are difficult to sort of mandate at the level that Heck is talking about, but I think at the institutional level, in terms of where each college or university can, in their own ways, mandate it. And I know that, for example, community colleges and some institutions, they require certain kinds of testing, they require certain kind of advising before they can do that. We certainly require financial aid advising before a student can receive their aid. They have to go through through advising around the package that they're receiving. So it's a tough issue, because again, you're talking about particularly faculty with faculty advisors, and it gets caught up in the tenure and promotion issue. That's a tough one to get.
And if I might add to that, I think that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is charged, has certain responsibilities that are well defined and certain abilities to directly influence universities and community colleges. But for the most part, I think we would agree that the power is through the checkbook, I mean, through the legislation. There have been proposals that have wanted to tie the opportunity grant to the actions of the particular university, which it, when you consider that 90% of students attend the university or college that's within 50 miles of their house, you're really kind of putting the opportunity of the student at risk due to the behavior of their local college. And so we're very cognizant of, I think, the levers that the HEC has and the impacts, the choices that we make about the opportunity grant or college university funding has on students as well as the universities.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. What a great conversation this is today. I just feel very privileged to be a part of this. I want to touch on kind of the responsibility of the state. And we are the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee, but there's a piece of this that if we don't connect well with my good colleague to my left, I think who is our nexus, with K-12, we can miss some significant opportunity. And I just want to raise as an issue for us to make sure that we're considering is that we are educating our high school students about not only how they get into the pipeline, but making sure that they're not missing an opportunity to apply for this money by not filling out a FAFSA in a timely manner. We don't want to disadvantage them by missing a deadline, and that's our responsibility to educate them to make sure that they have those benchmarks in front of them. And particularly for our minority, our underserved populations, sometimes our rural communities, our young men who tend not to participate at levels as high as our young women do in this day and age. And I've witnessed many times cultures in high school settings that are kind of a old philosophical approach to how you deal with students, which is the staff determining college-bound and not college-bound and drawing boundaries. And it's something that I just want to make sure that we are all aware of in not only educating our people who are working in our high schools, which is it's an issue of coming out of our training programs as graduates, that they understand that these doors should be open to all students. But truly, I've seen I've seen high schools that don't operate very well in that regard. And I think I just want to make sure that we are educating our high school students well, that the pipeline's there. This is how you get in it. This is what the deadlines are. And if you miss an opportunity, it's on you. But that we're doing our job well.
So Representative Reed, Representative McEwen, thank you. That was a great intro. Thank you very much. we're really pleased and proud that we've really been working at increasing the number of students and potential students that complete the FAFSA this last year. And on January 1st, which is the day the FAFSA opened, the federal government received twice as many FAFSAs from Oregon students as we had last year. Twice as many. It's an all-time record for the number of FAFSAs completed, and we'd love to take credit for that, but it's our folks that are in our Aspire high schools. The colleges are doing more to get the word out. We're doing radio ads, on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on every kind of social media you can imagine. So we're really, really pushing that. We've also entered, with the cooperation of the Federal Department of Education, what we're calling FAFSA Plus, a FAFSA completion project, where we enter into data sharing agreements with high schools, with community-based organizations, with our tribal partners. They send us a list of their seniors or their membership if they're a community-based organization, and we will check our records and say, you know, Johnny and Susie have completed the FAFSA, Lori hasn't, and Billy did, but he's got some errors he needs to fix. And we work cooperatively. We haven't seen the data yet in terms of year-over-year school-by-school comparisons, but we think we're going to see huge increases. So we have currently this is our first year, our pilot year. We've got 50 high schools signed up already. So I'm very excited about that.
That's a nice number, both because if you've seen twice a doubling, but you've only got 50 high schools, suggests there's perhaps a lot more room.
We know that college enrollment will be down this year. I mean, this is not, it's just a national trend. So we've seen the number of FAFSAs kind of level out to their historical low, but the fact that we got such a big surge at the beginning means that people are hearing the message and they're getting it done. And the other advantage, I think the great thing is if you fill out the FAFSA, and you're eligible for a Pell Grant, that's more federal money coming back to Oregon, which is always good news.
Right.
So.
And if I can add, we also in our work group tried to deal with the narrative that you talked about, you know, and our goal, and we've talked about it in HEC as well, the need to change some of those community narratives around, you know, our kids don't go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal is to figure out how do we incent the pipeline as early as possible so that within families they can say, but even if the teachers don't think their kids go to college, my kid can go to college.
Right.
And how do we begin to help people to begin to do that? And thinking that there's a relationship that's necessary, but again, that's a place where we need to do additional work to figure out what such a program might look like.
Thank you for your good work.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Actually, I just wanted to say that I think some of the elementary schools at least are starting to prepare their kids with that mindset to sort of change that culture. And I visited Earl Boyle's, which was Early Childhood Learning Center in David Douglas, and they have above each door, you know, class of 2025 or 26, whatever, I can't remember the years, but so those kids are right at that early age are starting to think. So I think your idea of let's make sure that they understand that they're going to get at least some level of financial support, you know, from that early age, so they know that it's not only desirable, but it's possible. They can do that. And then the other thing, since I am the connecting tissue here with the Education Committee, is that, you know, I think as we do a better job of career awareness throughout, and you get those kids that are graduating at a higher rate and they're motivated, they have some idea when they get up to college that they know why they're there, and even though they still may change their minds a little bit, but I think that we're moving in the right direction, and so you're reaching down to provide some motivation, and I think it's just great. So let's keep doing it.
Thanks, Representative Reardon.
Representative Reardon. Yes, it's great to go to an elementary school and see the pendants from all the Pac-12 schools hanging along the bulletin board. I won't comment which one should be in the middle, but it's great that they're planting that seed early on.
I was worried about the Michigan State one. I saw
we like those institutions in Oregon. They're not Pac-12
right.
too. But looks like we've exhausted the questions. I have one last one before we finish, which is I think it's embedded in a lot of your comments, sort of the direction you're headed with the amendments. But I like the fact that we're having this sort of introduction and a good discussion today in anticipation of you coming back with the amendments. Can you just summarize in a little bit more direct terms for our consideration as we head off to our weekends and our next conversation what you anticipate the amendments doing?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, I'll do my best. So the amendments are likely to establish that if state funding is insufficient to meet the full need as determined by the shared responsibility model in today's law, then the commission may award grants with using a fixed amount, which we're doing today, so that's not really a departure, may award it to the neediest students, may rely on expected family contribution as determined by the FAFSA as the basis for the need, for determining need, that it shall ensure that the award is made available to students year over year, assuming satisfactory academic progress. And that we may set aside dollars for a supplemental award that would reward students who persist and complete at full-time rates such that they could graduate in 4 years if they by taking 15 credits. So it's basically a statutory framework that would permit the commission to adopt the rules to guide OSAC in the administration of an award that meets the sort of criteria here. Part of the reason for not bringing this to you quite yet, one is that the commission met last week and took its sort of mostly final action on endorsing bringing this concept to you. Secondly, is there's still some pretty significant financial modeling to do. There are a lot of variables at play here. Including ones we don't control related to number of applicants and their level of need and tuition and cost of living, cost of attendance. So we're trying to really hone in on the modeling in order to provide you with a proposal that not only works statutorily, but we think is implementable along the lines of what we've described.
That helps. So it does prompt one specific question from me, which is why you describe, I'm probably not going to use the words exactly right, but a setting aside and a supplement for those who are taking 15 rather than 12, why not make it the requirement that you take 15 and be on track for graduation in 4 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, I know that the working group and the design team the working group concluded that this base award should remain available to students of all types and stripes, including the many, many students who do, for very understandable reasons and important reasons, attend part-time, that the award should not be narrowed to focus only on full-time students, particularly using this higher sort of threshold for full-time. So the commission's consideration of this sort of supplemental award program really should not come at the expense in any significant way of a base award that's available to students regardless of their level of attendance.
So there's basically going to be three levels then, right? Then the half-time, 12 credits, and full-time? Is that right?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think that's certainly one way of thinking about it that I think is accurate. You would have a one base award for half-time students between half-time and full-time, a second type of award, a larger award for full-time as defined as it has been conventionally, which is 12 credits, and then for returning students year over year, a supplemental award to essentially motivate, incentivize, and reward their decisions to not only enroll but successfully complete at that higher full-time definition that ensures they can graduate within the period for which Pell dollars and opportunity grant dollars are available. We've called it a tuition promise, by the way, because the commission has considered trying to peg the size of that supplemental award to average tuition increases. Mm-hmm. So students wouldn't actually experience, if they qualify for that award and earn that award, they wouldn't experience a year-over-year tuition increase. Still some challenges increase in the modeling of that and the implementation of that.
Okay. So maybe in the amendment it's worth considering the definition around that full-time, since what we've called full-time doesn't actually get you to graduation in 4 years. Maybe that's a definitional tweak. Other comments?
Mr. Chair, I've been quiet because we're going to see something different than what we have. I'm interested in the conversation, too, very much, and I've worked hard to improve access and cost of higher education. I really would like the numbers. Just I'm amazed. You know, some of this does go to community college, some of the opportunity grant, but I don't know how no income or no support from family are part of the shared responsibility models. Mm-hmm. How $1,000 is going to get a kid that we really want to get an education and with the cost of education today. So I wish you luck. I look forward to seeing what the amendment is, and I will be very supportive, but I just don't know how the numbers are going to. Tuition is, we said the student enrollment's down, so that's going to force tuition up probably. So some states are freezing tuition. Washington State, did you see that Washington State dropped their tuition significantly at their four-year universities? So tuition's a big factor, doctor and professor, mm-hmm. in this equation. When I first came in this building, we didn't have enough opportunity grant. We tried to up the opportunity grant, but we went to OSAC and said, do you want more money in opportunity grants or lower tuition? it's so there's a lot of
that tension remains. I think that's mm-hmm. something we'll wrestle with, and there's at least three of us on this committee that are also on the Ways and Means Committee that will struggle.
But
with
thank
that.
You, Mr. Chair, and the people for testifying, and wish them luck.
Thank you. Okay, we will look forward to seeing you again with the amendments. I understand they'll be submitted shortly, and we'll look forward to that that hearing as well. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2407? I don't see anyone. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2407 for today.
Not meeting Monday.
Okay, so good news for you, particularly those who are traveling back to us on Monday. We are not going to meet on Monday morning. So we'll enjoy your time. We're going to bank that for potential future use.
Chair Reed.
Anything else to come before the committee today?
Wait till 5.
Excellent.
Stand adjourned.
Thanks for the amendment thing. I think you make sense. Let's get it done here, sir. Thanks for the amendment thing. I think you make sense. Let's get it done here, sir.